Thank you. The way we're going to play this is I'm going to talk, I think, for about 20 minutes, not much longer. Then we're going to have a bit of a discussion for 10 minutes, then we're going to throw it open to you. So I'll try very hard to make sure we actually stick to that. It's very nice to be here. Nice to see this number of people. I have a secret hobby, which is I try and bag groups. And I've done the Chartists, the Levellers, the Toll Pedal Martyrs, numerous socialists and anarchists and so on. I've even done a Conservative Party conference once. This is my first diggers, so I'm very, very grateful. If I appear a bit tired, I apologise. It's the end of our term. We don't actually work that hard in Oxford. But I've been travelling. On Tuesday I was in Bracknell. I learned in Bracknell there are 42 wards in Bracknell, 41 of them vote Conservative. Because, I was told by the one Labour councillor, people bought their council houses, it's a new town. They weren't going to vote Labour because they thought they'd be taken back off them. So I learned things there. John MacDonald was there, and so we had a chat about things. Wednesday I was at a primary school, I was in London Thursday, here on Friday. I'm at Brooks on Monday. On Tuesday, I've been invited to the Cabinet Office to speak to the Treasury team, which is really weird because they've got nothing to do at 4 o'clock on Tuesday, because apparently the whole budget's all agreed, and then it comes out on Wednesday. But they did say, can you come and tell us about a plan B, just in case it all goes wrong? I think it's a good sign. And so on and so on. So that's my excuses if I'm not particularly lucid. And now we're going to do this in a somewhat different way. What I'd normally do is a summary about why inequality is terrible, but I suspect most of you think inequality and injustice are bad and you don't need much convincing. So what I'm going to do, Andrew very kindly sent me his questions earlier, and I'm actually going to answer them now. So we can get on to more complicated questions. So I'm going to talk about some of the things that I argue that are more controversial amongst people who tend to agree that inequality is very bad, it's terrible having food banks and so on. The Injustice book, which came out in 2010, took years to write, 8 publishers turned it down, was the edition that's out there, it was the second edition done in 2015, and we added a centimetre to it, based purely on what has happened between 2010 and 2015. All the kind of shocking examples of how terrible things were, when I looked up the latest statistic on them, they were almost always much worse. And this wasn't just homelessness figures and the extent of people who are being sanctioned and so on. It was at the upper end of society as well. The highest fees for a private nursery are now 4 times higher than they were 5 years ago. The top salaries are now much higher. The 1,000 richest people have doubled their wealth in those 5 years. So things are changing very rapidly, and it was a crash, but it is interesting how fast it changed, and things are still happening rapidly. The world's billionaires actually lost quite a lot of money in the last 6 weeks. We have no idea whether it's going to stay like that. But the reason for pointing these things out to you is I do think it's wrong to think that there is any certainty about what's going to happen, particularly now. I do think things are in incredible flux. I think anything could happen in the next 5, 8, 10 years. I think at some point the London housing bubble is going to crash. The more that Osborne stokes it up, the bigger the crash will be. The question is, what kind of society do you want in the future? What is it that we would rather have? We would rather have it by arguing for it, but if events carry on being this unpredictable, we could get something very different simply out of default. And if people haven't got an idea about what to do when house prices fall by 30% in London, we may get something even worse. The important thing about this is it isn't a Luftwaffe and it isn't a tsunami. All the houses would still be there. You know, the idea that this is a tragedy, we shouldn't hold So dear. I'll just tell you what the five main arguments in injustice are, and then I'll start going through these questions. The first is that the elite think that elitism is efficient. That is that we do need special schools, especially gifted children, special universities for them, and so on. This kind of argument extends all the way up, this is probably where I'll give you the first controversial thing for you, to why I think a group of seven Conservative ministers want us to leave the EU, and probably quite a few others do. It's because they think they're much more capable than those politicians across Europe. So if we had sovereignty, then Boris, with his enormous brain, would lead us to have another empire. It's that kind of thinking. Elitist thinking that a few people are incredibly able leads to terrible, terrible mistakes. The second is that exclusion is necessary. We have to have social exclusion. You have to starve people into wanting to work. We have to imprison more people per head than anywhere else in Europe. It's all just necessary. Even though when you compare us to other countries on this continent, you'll see that the poorest 20% here are poorer than anywhere else, at least in Western Europe. The richest 10% take a higher share of income than anywhere in Europe, 28%. We're the most unequal country in Europe, and we have the highest imprisoned population per head. The third is that it's natural to be prejudiced. It's natural to have some racism, these kind of things. It's natural to look down on the skivers and to think of yourself as a prudent, hard-working family person and a saver, and all this is innate in human nature. The fourth is very familiar to you, which is greed is good. Greed is good is a belief held amongst the elite. The elite are not stupid enough to say it that often. So you have to read two-thirds of the way through Robert Peston's book before you get to the sentence that says the truth is that greed is actually good. And without the greedy, we wouldn't be anywhere. And the fifth is that despair is inevitable. We're always going to have a huge amount of sickness, enormous amount of poor mental health and so on, and we really should try to cut down on the cost of treating this, which is partly because this argument is believed amongst people at the top, is why our health spending is the lowest in Europe now, apart from Greece, which has only just started spending less per head than we do. We spend half as much as Switzerland, about 40% less than Germany, less than France, on our healthcare. We have an incredibly efficient healthcare system, although it broke down in January, February, March 2015. Overstunning things happening, and I'm not going to try not to give you any more statistics if I can. But last year, 2015, there was a 5% rise in mortality and deaths in this country, in England and Wales. There was an 8.5-9% increase in deaths in Scotland. 2014 wasn't a particularly special year. 2012, 13, 14, we've had high rates of deaths. A 5-9% increase in deaths hasn't happened at any point since at least the 1960s. And in the 1960s, I think it was people coming into the country because of immigration rules, why more died. This is the biggest rise in mortality since wartime. It will all come out over the course of this year, but the shocking thing for me, and we also didn't have that much flu last winter, the shocking thing for me is all four chief medical officers for Northern Ireland, Scotland, Wales and England have not yet said anything about the biggest increase in people dying. These are elderly people, mainly elderly women, dying faster than they would otherwise die. The share price of Britain's largest undertaker rose 40% during the course of last year. And that shows you how stupid speculators are, because there's only a limited number of people. You know, you can't actually carry on. But things... If somebody had told me in 2005 that all this was going to happen, I would have just said they were fantasies. But what's shocking is the adaptation to it happening. Getting used to the food banks, getting used to a million people being sanctioned, and the amount of sanctions being greater than all the fines given out in magistrates' courts and sheriff's courts in a year. So we take away money from the poorest people in society more than we take it away from people who've committed crimes. And the kind of reason that somebody is sanctioned is because they don't go to a job interview because they have to look after their sick child. It's women. Anyway, let's stop that. Stop the normal moaning and go into the kind of issues that are more complicated. I talk a lot about tax in the book, and I mainly talk about it in punitive terms. And Andrew said, couldn't I talk a bit more like Tony Juddler's about tax being beneficial, about it being something you should feel happy about paying? It means you're part of something greater. Every time you see your tax go, you should say, aren't I lucky to live in a country which has a decent amount of tax? Which I hope they do in Finland, where they have the highest rate in tax in Europe, and the best schools, and some of the best health services. And they're not flocking out of Finland, even though it's cold. But you can look at every other country in Europe, apart from Ireland, and they tax higher. And they don't just tax a bit higher. We're taking much less than 40% of GDP in tax, they're taking over 50%. It makes all the difference. That difference in tax take is almost discretionary spending. It's what allows you to make your society really nice. And I do agree, we should talk about how we're lucky to pay tax, but I do think it's beneficial to talk about punitive taxes as well. John MacDonald isn't going to raise the top rate of tax, he says. He's just going to restore the 50% rate. That's not a raise, it's a restoration. He's beginning to learn how to speak. I would raise the top rate of tax. Thomas Piketty has shown why. In those countries which kept high marginal tax rates, inequality hasn't risen. These are countries like Germany. They're not basket cases. But the reason for increasing the top rate of tax is that there are some people who are greedy. And it's a very interesting academic question about whether they're naturally greedy, whether they genetically lack emotion. We know the majority of human beings are pro-social, but we know there's a minority who are not, including, of course, a very dangerous minority amongst that group. And I think for those people who are greedy, you need high marginal rates of tax. And you need it. I'll use Jeremy Clarkson, because I'm sure he's not going to sue me. Jeremy Clarkson is getting on a bit. Okay. Supposing Jeremy Clarkson is offered to do a 2-week show in Australia. I think it would really help Jeremy, if you're, say, bringing in $2 million a year, to know that if he did some work in Australia on top of that, he'd be paying 80 or 90% tax rate. It would help him, because then he'd have to decide, if he really wanted to go to Australia and drive cars around for 2 weeks, or not. Because he wouldn't be doing it for the money, because all the money would be going in tax. Or if you think of the case of bankers who are fairly greedy, you've got a banker younger than me in London, they know how to use a computer and their bosses don't. They discover that another banker is being paid $1 million or 2 million more than them. They threaten to leave unless their pay is put up. If they were facing, and this is, we're now talking several million pounds, I'm a realist, so this, you might all want to say, come and just have a society that's all flat. This is how you get towards that. If this young banker wants an extra million because he's found out another man's got another million, if he was going to have to pay 90% tax on that, so he'd only get 100,000, would he want it as much? And would the board give it him, knowing that they'd be giving 900,000 to Treasury and only 100,000 to him? So that's my argument for punitive taxes. It's to control people who can't control themselves. It's not to raise money. You actually want to raise less and less. Your ideal is, as your marginal tax rate goes up for high-income tax earners, it actually brings in less money because people stop being so greedy and having those salaries. If we could get the salaries of financiers down, junior doctors wouldn't be bothered. They'd be very, very happy with their pay. What junior doctors are complaining, apart from the hours and the danger, the reason they're worrying about the pay is because financiers are now paid more than them. You always have a 1%. Even in a very equal society, 1% of people were paid a little bit more than everybody else. When I was young, the 1% included people running small businesses and factories, head teachers and doctors, and not bankers. They actually got paid less. I've got to go quickly through some of these. I argue that there isn't an orchestrated conspiracy. And this is one of the things that most annoys people. That we haven't become the most unequal country in Europe because a group of people met and planned in the Monday Club and in Mayfair for years and knew what they were doing. It's very convenient for people on the left to think there was an organised conspiracy and that's why we failed in the 60s and 70s, unlike most other countries, because we were up against some really clever people from Harrow and Eton who were plotting and planning. I have just never seen any evidence for it. And whenever I've met these people, and I increasingly meet them, they're not that clever. Or they're incredibly good at appearing not to be that clever. And this is worse than an organised conspiracy, because it's an organised conspiracy you can expose and so on. You know, Margaret Thatcher carried, what was the book she carried in a handbag?
Hayek.
She carried Hayek in a handbag, and the idea was, you know, Sir Keith Joseph and that lot had a particular plan, and they met in the Montpellier Society. I don't think this is what really drove things. One of the things which drove things in this country was that we never realised how much money we made out of having an empire. George Orwell said this around about 1945, that the Labour Party could create a welfare state because the country was rich, because it had an income from empire. When the colonies got independence and went, India first in a big way and then in Africa, that was something that didn't happen to other European countries. And it's things like that, differences like that, I think, more than an organised conspiracy. The media. How influential is the media in shaping our political discourse and reinforcing these beliefs? The media matters, but I think it reflects the views of the elite. So you can look back at the Daily Mail on the day when the Beveridge Report was published, and there's a lovely cartoon saying, "Cheers to Beveridge, the British people are going to get what they finally deserve," in the Daily Mail back then. The whole of politics moves to the right and moves to the left. We were most unequal around about 1913. Half our inequality went by 1913. The press and our elite moved leftwards and leftwards. Conservatives built more council houses than the Labour Party. The papers changed. And then from the late 1970s onwards, when the last of the colonies had gone, we swung to the right. The rich didn't want to give up their wealth. The southeast of England voted Conservative in October 1974, the second election. Not enough, so Labour won. But the actual swing was the voters. Then Thatcher came in 75. Then she won an election in 79. The inequality keeps on growing. And as it grew, our newspapers stepped to the left-wing newspapers closed. Elite beliefs moved that way. And it's entirely possible to get a swing round and back the other way. But I don't think it's just the media. The BBC, the simple characterisation of the BBC is whenever they retire, almost always they come out and say, of course I was apolitical and I was working at the BBC, but I am a One Nation Tory. That's what your standard BBC view is, but that is what the standard view of people in the top 2 or 3% of society is. I'm going to skip forward now, just a couple more minutes. Positive signs of change. So I mentioned Occupy once. Do I view the election of Corbyn and the votes that Sanders has been getting as, you know, interesting? I mean, they are interesting, but it's not Corbyn and it's not Sanders that matters. Particularly not Corbyn. That's what's really nice about Corbyn. You know, he is not a charismatic super leader. And one danger is that people have a tendency to think what we need are some leaders to lead us out of this. The important thing about Sanders and Corbyn for me is all the people who voted for them, not them. It's the fact that so many people were willing to pay £3 and do that. The fact that a large number of young people did join and still belong to Momentum. It began with Barack Obama with a crowdsourcing campaign in America. Things that are happening that are involving lots of people doing very small actions differently to that they did before. The small actions can include simply confronting, in a slightly polite way, a relative at Christmas who says something a bit bigoted. And you might have let it go for the last 7 Christmases. You know, but this Christmas, you know, you don't want to cause a stir, but you don't really want them to go away thinking that you agree with them. Maybe it's the time to do that. It's those kind of actions. I wish I had a way of proving this. But it's those kind of things that matter. If you were going to try to prove this, what you would do is look back at the past and say, well, what happened after the Titanic sank and after the First World War to mean that we progressively became more equal and made society better in so many ways, decade after decade after decade? What was going on? And I mentioned William Beveridge earlier. If you look at the early work of William Beveridge, you can see he was a eugenicist. He said every middle class family should have four children for the race, the British race, the super race that the world really needed to rule it. So it's the same man, still a liberal, but same man who later on managed to do some fairly useful things and certainly stopped saying those views later on in life. So who made him do it? Well, his brother-in-law was a bloke called Tawney, and Tawney wrote a book about equality. But what made Tawney like he was? These were two boys who'd been to rugby school. You know, they were in the 0.1%. And Tawney famously was injured and was in no man's land, you know, which does kind of make you think. But it wasn't just that. It was that he talked to people when he was out there in the First World War. All that stuff about people talking to each other, both out there at war, but also back at home, when you rub shoulders with people you'd never rubbed shoulders with before, that small individual actions. And I think, just as I said earlier, all those votes in the southeast of England for the Conservatives in 1974 were small individual actions of people who'd had enough of the miners in 1973 and were happy to jettison the north and the poor, and eventually buy their council houses in Bracknell, although they'd been voting Labour back then. So I do think the actions of individual people matter. Diggers. We should end on the diggers. Oh, I should end my bit on the diggers. One of the issues the diggers had was land ownership and the importance of the ownership of land and, in effect, the ownership of property. If you compare different rich countries in the world, it is often land which was one of the key changes. So 100 years ago, probably the most unequal country in the world was Japan. Japan had an aristocracy, a very strict society. It then just come out of a feudal situation and had incredible land inequality in Japan by the 1930s. When the Americans invaded Japan after the bomb, first thing they did was to requisition the land and then redistribute the land as equal as they could, confiscating it from the aristocracy, because you need to destroy the elite of a country if you've just beaten them in war. But also, the Americans were incredibly afraid of a revolution. They thought the Japanese would have a communist revolution. So they made the Japanese the most equal people in the world. Not out of wanting to create an actual experiment in what happens. But the end result was that Japan went from having one of the lowest life expectancies in the rich world in the 1930s to having the highest life expectancy by the 1980s. With Japanese women living 8 years longer than Japanese men, and Japanese men being the longest lived men in the world. And I could say many other things about Japan. But we did a mini version of this in Germany. In other countries in mainland Europe, people controlled the amount of property. There's a wealth tax in France. In France, the average family, the median family in France, is several thousand euros a year better off than the median family in this country. But these statistics are never said. I think the ownership of property is key. I think George Osborne knows why it's key, which is why he spent more money on every budget since 2010 on housing than anything else. Not on building housing for people, on actions that will shore up the house price so that people can think they've got an asset of value. The latest wheeze is to underwrite 40% of the mortgages of people who buy property in London under 600,000, which is actually a fairly small flat in a lot of London. This is going to push the price of almost anything under 600,000 towards 600,000. And mean that we are guaranteeing to the bank that when and if the property prices fall, we will pay the bank the first 40% of the fall before they repossess the flat. This has been his major policy for the last few years, help to buy It is getting banks to lend to people mortgages that they wouldn't lend to otherwise because the bank thinks the risk is too high. But the British people just cannot see it because they've been taught that their ownership of land makes them safe. And that's why, right at the beginning, I said about a housing market crash. The last time prices rose in a large city as fast as this anywhere in the world was in Tokyo in the late 1980s, and then they halved, and they're still at roughly that kind of a level. So that's the precedent for what happened before. If you want a really earlier precedent, my favourite one is Amsterdam. The United Provinces were the richest country in the world before we were. Amsterdam house prices peaked in 1675 on the canal, and then fell gradually for 300 years. And I always think about this, whenever people tell me that house prices in London will never fall, you just look to everything else. I won't try and say any more about house prices, but the important thing is not whether they fall or when they fall or what happens. But when all those university students, which include the majority of girls now go to university in England, all those university students with their massive debts who won't be able to buy houses become 30, you can see what's going to happen. It's not that, it's what are you going to do afterwards? What kind of a society do you want? And if people don't start talking about that, then when the opportunity comes, the opportunity could easily be squandered again, as it was in 2008. Thank you very much for listening to me droning on. I did manage to keep that roughly to 20 minutes.
Just to say, there are some seats around there on the front. So over to Andrew now, who's going to be...
Yes, as Tony said, my name's Andrew Bradstock. I've been invited to just have a conversation with Danny following up his excellent presentation. I'd like to keep this short, actually, because one of the things that worries me is the way in which the media shapes our discourse for us, or tries to. And I find that quite frustrating, because I think we want to break out of that. And I don't want to shape the discourse this evening on your behalf. I think it would be much more profitable to have a wide-ranging conversation where we all join in. But I think my remit is really to just sort of kick off the discussion. And can I just say that I do recommend Danny's books. I'm not just saying that he's sitting next to me, but they are delightfully clearly written. And I was going to say for an academic, but they are. And they're written in a kind of conversational style. It's almost as though he's sitting across you in the train talking to you. And they're really easy to follow and pick up the arguments. And so I do recommend that you get a copy of, certainly of the Injustice book, and also the new one that's just come out, which there's some copies out there called A Better Politics, which I had a quick look at the PDF on the way up, and that's equally stimulating and a good read. The five beliefs that Danny's started by mentioning, elitism, exclusion, prejudice, greed and despair, are the kind of leitmotif of that book on injustice. But I still want to sort of probe a bit more as to how it is that so many of us supposedly hold those beliefs. I did ask you about the fact that you argue there's no conspiracy, and I'll go along with that. You also touched on the role of the media in kind of perpetuating the same kind of agenda that the elite might have. But it does seem interesting to me that we do kind of buy into these ideas, and you make the point time and again in the book that it's beliefs that matter and it's beliefs that we hold. So I just wondered if you could start by just saying a bit more about how these ideas are maintained, and then I suppose what would be involved in breaking through that. You kind of said, well, you know, it could be a chance conversation or whatever, but it does seem to me that something's got to happen to us on a kind of almost individual level to break through that, to, as Leonard Cohen says, you know, the light to get in so that we can see it in a different way.
That they're held most strongly by a large number of people in the very best off 1% of society. That's where they're most held. They're not quite well held as you go down the kind of income and wealth order, but it is in the interest of people who believe these things to be true that enough people in the rest of the population believe it, otherwise they're not going to hold power. So they need you to believe that immigration has ruined your housing stock and means why the schools don't work. And they might think that themselves, even though it isn't the answer. The reason I think it's knife-edged is just personal experience over... I know people working in newspapers, very high up in newspapers, right-wing newspapers, who are not right-wing, but they need a job. And they say it is just the editor, the deputy editor, and the owners, and a few of the more obnoxious columnists. But they're partly not that right-wing because they're struggling to pay a mortgage, but they're lucky enough they managed to get a mortgage. But things aren't going well for them. For the 99% of people in society have actually become more equal. We've had a concatenation. It's the 1%. But the other, I mean, just one last anecdote. I was on a BBC TV programme talking about wealth and inequality, and the presenter, who lives in a six-bedroom house in Belsize Park, was arguing that it was fine. There were six other people in the room, the producer, the camera person, the sound person, and two people I'd had no idea what they were doing. And every time I said something, they were all nodding. It was only the presenter, who was far better off than everybody else in the room, who agreed. And it's, of course, you know, it isn't the case that this is just us and them. But at the very top of society, these views are normal. They're seen as simply sensible. You know, of course, this is me being a top society. Of course my children are specially gifted. It might be genetic, or it might just be my brilliant upbringing of my children. So I must make sure my children have the right education. I'll do that by spending a lot of money and getting myself in the right school catchment area. But if my child doesn't do too well in that very posh comprehensive, I'll ask the grandparents for some money, and because it's only fair on the children, and I'll send them to a private school. And then, of course, we must have some universities for these children because we need them to rule us, because only some are up to it. And you don't necessarily say it like that, but I cannot mention where my children in Oxford go to school in middle-class Oxford society because people will look at me as if I'm a child abuser. For the fact that they go to a school which is actually slightly posher than the one I went to. But this is England. You know, if they're spending money on their kids' school, and I'm not spending money on my kids' school, one of us has got to be wrong. And what the English don't understand, because this doesn't happen in Scotland so much, but it does actually in Edinburgh, but certainly doesn't happen in Wales, the rest of Europe doesn't have private schools. Really doesn't have, hardly any. And the ones they have, they laugh about. So my favourite example is Bonn. Bonn is twinned with Oxford. It's very hard for school teachers in Bonn to rank the schools in Bonn. Eventually they say the Beethoven Academy is a bit Tory, but these are all state schools. But they do have one private school in Bonn. And the private school in Bonn is for the very slow boys of the upper classes. If your child is very slow, and the most famous alumni of that school in Bonn is Prince Philip. And we should know this. You know, we should know. But this is how it's maintained. You've got, you remember, 7% of kids go, and I'm not, it's nobody's fault where they go to school, okay? You know, most people, 7% of kids go to school, almost all of the top 1% go to private school, almost all of the top 1% do. If you're sending your children to these special schools that cost more, how do you justify that in your own head? Unless you think that there are deep inequalities from childhood onwards, and it's you're doing a favour to the lower orders by educating your child well, because then your child can rule the lower orders well. And that's rational in a particular kind of logic. And then your child can make a great sacrifice, and rather than make millions of pounds in PR, your child can become Prime Minister. As a sacrifice, giving you his brilliant ability that has been so well honed that he'll be a custodian.
Didn't Alec Douglas Hume's mother say once, isn't it really good of Alec to do Prime Minister?
Yeah.
So another big question around this is, do the 1%, do you think they actually do believe that there's no alternative to those five beliefs, or do they have a sneaking suspicion it might be, but actually it's not in their interest to accept that and promote that?
I think they think there isn't much alternative for England. So I think they can see why in other countries things might have evolved differently, but I think they think they're saving England from dropping down further, and they just say it isn't possible. And also some of them on the right think we have a glorious future of becoming rich again because of their innate greatness. You've got to remember, they have better genes than anybody else on the planet. There is this fantasy on the right of Britain being great again, in effect having an empire again, our banks getting their reputation again. And the right played this game from 1979 through, did the Big Bang in 86. It looked to be working. And we were becoming the biggest financial centre in the planet. We could be the centre of a financial empire, if not an old colonial empire. You know, it partly looked to be working. It was only the 2008 crash that suddenly said, this is built on a house of sand. And I think on the middle of the road, say New Labour, you know, the kind of New Labour belief, the Tony Blair belief of, let's just be a bit nicer to the poor, but we will still ensure that the really able people rule. There is no problem with people being stinking rich as long as they pay their taxes, but I'm happy for their wealth and income to rise and rise again. There's no problem with me personally if I'm Tony Blair amassing a property empire of £60 million, which is what he's done, because I deserve it. Because I've done such good for the world, creating peace in the Middle East, whatever I've been doing, and other people don't have it in. And I think this goes all the way across. And you've got to go, you know, to a Member of Parliament for Islington who didn't want to be nominated, you know, who clearly didn't believe this, who had the lowest expenses in Parliament at the time the Telegraph went through. And that hasn't come out. Jeremy Corbyn had the lowest expenses.
At £12.
Yeah, less than Chris Mullin, because he didn't claim for a TV licence. You know, nobody says, well done, Chris, you only claimed for a black and white TV licence. Nobody says, why did you claim for that TV licence, Chris? You know, but anyway, it's nothing compared to Duck House.
Yeah. But that's an example, really, of what I was trying to say earlier about reframing the debate. I mean, you've done it yourself this evening. In a sense, I was thinking when you were talking about people in the city discovering that someone earns a couple of million more than they do. That, in a sense, is the politics of envy. And yet, that's a term that's often thrown at socialists or people, you know, who want a kind of more equal society. I mean, in one of your books as well, you talk about that, you know, we're always told there's not enough housing to go around. And yet, in fact, as you say, there's tons of housing around, but the trouble is it's second, third and fourth homes of people that are not really occupied. I mean, it's that kind of reframing of the debate that actually would, I think, click in people's minds and enable them to see the world in a different light. But I'm just wondering how that's going to happen, given that the media generally tends to reinforce the status quo and encourage us. I mean, it's frightening when you watch something like Question Time or the debate around the general election, and you see people in the audience kind of just trotting out stuff that they've heard on the media, whether it's their experience or not, but the same phrases that you see in the headline on the Daily Mail.
They do, but if you look at who they put on Question Time, you know, every so often you get Will Self or somebody else, but it's the business person. Then it's the Tory, it's the middle-ranking Labour. Any questions was on tonight. Well, it's probably on now, actually, isn't it? But it was a businessman, then a local Conservative MP, then a Labour and somebody else. But there wasn't anybody who says anything like what I say. And this idea that somehow people running large businesses have some special right to be on these panels, but the people who work for them, who of course are 10 or 15 times more than them, get no representation on these panels, but you wouldn't want them on because they're not articulate. What would be the point of having them on, they wouldn't know or understand. Now, you could get away with that in the past, but our school leaving age now is near 18, and as I said, half of all girls in England are going to university. How are you going to carry on, given we've done this, telling people they're too stupid to understand? And I think that's coming through. I mean, the other thing you've got to remember, anybody who's older than me is very unlikely to be able to have gone to a comprehensive because it didn't exist. There weren't many of them. They all came in, most of them came in the 1970s. So you've got to be my age or less to have gone to school with everybody else. If you're older than me, or you're unlucky enough to have been in Kent or somewhere, then at the age of 11, you're either told that you're really fit and put in with everybody who fails 11 plus, and that's most of you, and that's a really good way of hobbling people. I've met thousands of academics, I know three who went to secondary moderns, and they're brilliant, but it stops you for life. Or you went to the grammar, and okay, you might be like Alan Bennett and a bit open and, you know, but you were taken away from everybody else at 11, and you were told that you were a bit special. My mum went to one, so I can be, you know, she's lovely. But it's just something different happened. And that generation is moving through. Most of them are younger than me. They're perfectly capable, if not more capable, than the generation who were mixed. So I have a lot of optimism of what is possible, and I've got a lot of excuses as to why we didn't get there. And, a really important excuse just for England is the fact that we were the richest country on the planet 100 years ago. It is very hard, if that happens to you and your country becomes poorer, to adapt to it and become normal. Your upper classes find it really, really hard because they're not like other countries' upper classes. You know, their great-grandparents owned entire slave plantations. You know, daddy was a very successful stockbroker. Or if you're the poor oik one, daddy had a wallpaper manufacturing, in the case of the Chancellor. There's that legacy, and also the George Orwell thing, the legacy of the Labour movement, never quite realising that we got an NHS and we got insurance and we got pensions partly off the back of India. So we weren't actually getting it by sharing out inside that much. We were still doing it from a legacy of empire. Whereas if you compare us to countries that actually do stand on their own feet, which are most European countries, people see other people as like them. We call it the class system, but it's not seeing other people as like you. And I think it takes a couple of generations or more. And it's the Americans are going to have this in spades in future.
I mean, another thing that strikes me about your talk tonight and also your writing is that a lot of the material you're dealing with is quite depressing, really, but there's always a kind of upbeat edge to what you're saying. You said tonight, we just don't know what's going to happen in 5 years' time, which I think I read as a sign of optimism.
Yeah.
And you talked about Corbyn and Sanders and the fact that it's not about individuals leading us out. One of the extraordinary things, it seemed to me, about the people who've fallen in behind Corbyn and Sanders is their age. These are young, largely young people who, for whom, I mean, I don't know, perhaps I'm out of touch now, I haven't hit 60, but it seems to me that they've grown up in a context where talk of kind of socialism or even the common good or something is a bit marginal.
Yeah.
And I just wonder where you think they, and Occupy as well, I suppose, and people around Russell Brand. I mean, there's a number of sort of signs of difference there going on. I mean, where do you think that's come from? And is that a genuine sign of hope, you think, that a generation is growing up who, despite the odds, really, are kind of...
I think it is. One reason to be hopeful is we're at the bottom of the class. You know, we are the most unequal country in Europe. Whenever something's at an extreme, it's a very good odds just to bet that it will move slightly towards the middle. Supposing I'd been sitting here writing in 1978, and I was very, very able, and I said, this is what the future's going to be. That would have been a cause for depression. If you'd actually have said, we're going to have mass unemployment, 3 million people within 4 years, then we're going to see the financial boom, the housing market go off, but with this residualisation of council housing, and go through what happens. That would be depressing. But given where we are, the scope for it being good is very high. And this happened to my granddad. My granddad was born in 1916. He saw the general strike. He was sent to war by men who should have known better because they'd already had one war. And he could see the other one coming. And his generation of men never forgave the generation above them who sent them to war, who didn't learn from the stock market crash for at least 5 years after 1929. And that generation, you know, then eventually created the comprehensive schools but also changed society. And for most of his life, things got better and better and better. He said the biggest change was that people started wearing different clothes. That was, everybody dressed the same apparently. And towards the end of his life, he lived into his 90s, he phoned me up once to ask if he was dead. And I said, I don't think you're dead unless I'm dead. I said, what is it? And he said, I've just been phoned up and asked when I want my operation. And he said, I'm in my early 90s, I've got nothing to do and nowhere to go. But what are they doing wasting time giving me a choice about when I have my operation? And, you know, things you'd have never thought possible happened. I really can imagine in 20 or 30 years' time they're talking about falling rates of anxiety amongst 15-year-old girls. Lower suicide, less self-harming, you know, less angst, less greed. No food banks. You know, we managed for decades between soup kitchens and food banks not to have any. A Labour Party actually pledges that there won't be any in 5 years. The Labour Party finds it hard to make that pledge. People not worrying about housing. People able to start a family at 27. You know, it's not much of a utopia. But, you know, it's asking for so little.
One last question from me, and then we'll open up. You ended by saying about how we ought to initiate a conversation about what sort of society we want, which is something that we're not used to doing. In fact, we, you know, it's bizarre, really, in some ways, that we live in a society and we never sort of ask what the purpose of it is, where it's going. I mean, no one would join a club without knowing why it existed and where it was going, what its aims were. I suppose in Scotland they had that kind of conversation around the independence referendum. It was kind of, what kind of country do you want? What sort of union? What would need to happen to spark that kind of conversation? Because it would be a very exciting thing, providing it wasn't just a talk fest and actually ended in some kind of action.
Okay, it's got further in Scotland. I mean, a lot of books, too many books for me to read, and some very thick ones about what we want Scottish society to be. And in a sense, they've got 90% of it in Scotland. They've got one-party politics, you know, 50-odd people who most of them didn't expect to be there. They've got control of most things devolved in Scotland. To the extent, if I tell you quietly, the Scottish university budget's 1 billion, the Scottish entire budget's 36. They've told the Scottish vice-chancellors that they really can't have chauffeurs. You know, it's not decent. And it's a very tiny thing. Loads of statistics are getting much, socialists are getting much better in Scotland. And they're kind of trying to cherry pick a mixture of Denmark and other countries that it would be nice to be that's happening. The sad thing is you'd have thought an EU referendum would be an opportunity to talk genuinely about what kind of future you want to be. And, you know, what kind of a country in Europe, given that all these other countries in Europe are in the EU, if you're talking about leaving, you know, rather than being the British Empire Mark II, you know, has anybody given, you actually say, we want to be like Norway that isn't in but pays, and look at what Norway is as a society? Lowest child poverty rate in the world. And the difference between us and Norway is if you were a bunch of Norwegians, and I said that, I said you've got the lowest child poverty rate in the world, three people would go, it's too high, it's a shame, we should be embarrassed about it. And it's the best rate, and that's why they have the lowest rate in the world. We're not going to get it with the EU referendum. We may get it in the run-up to the election. What we're going to get with the EU referendum we need to get ready for is we're going to get 5 weeks of extreme racism in the last 5 weeks. Yeah. That's my prediction. Yeah. If you want a date to remember, because I gave this date to the BBC yesterday and they ignored it, that the BBC are doing Immigration Day on May 16th. On May 14th, 1940, the last Kinder transport train left out of Europe. And it took 72 children, and I think the 72 children arrived on May the 16th, 1940. So the 72, the last children, Kinder transport children to get out, will arrive on the day that the BBC have chosen to discuss migration in a balanced manner with UKIP. The response of the BBC to me, well, only one BBC producer, but their response to me suggested that perhaps they should mention that the children turned up, was to say, what a pity it's the 74th anniversary. We tend to prefer round numbers like 75. That was, I've got the email. I stopped myself applying to it because I've got old and because I want things to change rather than just have arguments. And I stopped myself saying, go on, try and have a balanced debate about whether we should have allowed those children in or not. I'm sure you can find somebody who said we shouldn't, but do it. But I think we're going to need things like that for the last 5 weeks. But you never know, I am an optimist. You might get the most incredible backlash to the racism that we're going to see coming, particularly from London. You know, you might just see it. When Zach Goldsmith pulls that card, which he's going to pull about Sadiq being a Muslim, because that's the way Zach can get the majority votes, if the backlash comes, the how dare you? And this is the very opposite to what the Archbishop said today, by the way. Yeah. If, you know, that's the spark. It's a spark. What you need is a spark for something to happen. And maybe you need something really insulting, like people trying to play the race card, even though they know they've got almost no chance of a leave vote, still doing it.
Well, thank you, Dan. We've got, let's have half an hour before the refreshment. Is that right, Tony? So, over to you.
As an ex-Grammar School pupil from Kent, forget that straight away. There seems to be an argument, certainly, I believe you've become aware that I suppose perhaps I'm slow in the last few weeks, that's beginning to form around the idea that my generation are responsible for a younger generation's poverty. And this seems to be one which is beginning to play out now politically, where politicians are picking this up. And I'm wondering whether, I mean, I feel an element of guilt instinctively about this. I'm not sure that I should, but I'm worried that that's going to be a situation which is going to be exploited, an argument going to be exploited, taking the focus away from the elite and putting it on the shoulders of my generation as though we are to blame. And having just read a short story by Margaret Atwood where the young people scorn the care home of the wealthy and set fire to it, I am
most
concerned about
it. Yeah. No, I mean, my real personal selfish reason for bothering about this, I am a well-off, very well-off man. Even for the very well-off, if I'm lucky, I might make it through to my 80s or even late 80s, but probably not as long as my granddad. Those last 5 years will not be a bad 5 years if the people working in my care home are happy. If they're not happy, it'll be torture. So just personally for me, I need a society which will look after the elderly. David Willetts is the one who wrote the book The Pinch about this intergenerational change. I don't think David deliberately thought this is clever. You know, let's talk about this and not talk about the fact that there's some rich families and the money just flows down and some poor families where, you know, the grandparents don't have anything and the kids don't have anything. There's no intergenerational difference. I think it'll go away once people realise that the supposed wealth of the elderly isn't there. So the majority of the wealth is now housing equity. But that housing equity is based on the idea that somebody will buy your house when you downsize. And what people haven't thought about is who's going to buy it. Now, it could all be landlords. We could, and this is happening in Oxford and London, most houses are being sold to landlords. So, you know, you and maybe I could sell our house to a landlord, but you can only have so many landlords. It's about 3% of the population of landlords, and that's including buy-to-let. It's not that high. And once that's sold, then you go back to 1910 society, 90% renting. And at that point, you work out, oh yes, that intergenerational thing was a lie. But I come back to this, you know, educated. I think people are going to begin to work out that the supposed wealth of the elderly isn't there. Firstly, in actually realising the asset if you'll buy it, but also in the fact that that wealth largely gets spent in old age. I've drawn a map for a new atlas that's coming out in April of Britain of the proportion of people who pay inheritance tax. So we know in every area how many people pay inheritance tax every year, and we know how many die, and we divided one by the other, and the highest rates in Kensington and Chelsea, and it's only 17% there. There are at least 100 areas of the country, places like Hull is the largest, where not a single person pays inheritance tax now. Because people don't actually end up that wealthy, most people. But they think they will. Nuneaton thinks it is. Probably Wellingborough, you know, probably people have added it all up and say, you know, look how much my house has made. Without just thinking who is going to buy it and what are they going to buy it with? You know.
Yeah. I just want to say something a bit about landlordism. Now, I was lucky enough to just about manage to qualify for the mortgage last year. When I lived in this house, the most wonderful thing to find was an almost complete set of deeds going back to 1874, this little two up, two down terrace house in Kettering nearby. Mm. The one owner who was missing from it was the previous owner, and I forgot the conveyors and documents from them. So I actually had a complete history of this house. Now, the interesting thing is, having built in 1874, this always changed hands as a terrace of six houses up until 1950, when it was purchased using a mortgage provided by Kettering Borough Council under the Small Dwellings Acquisitions Act. And then, obviously, it was changed hands a few more times, and you can see that it changed hands very little in 1979, somewhat more in 2010. Yeah. Now, shortly before 2010, there is a landlord gas safety certificate. So you can look at this 140 years, and you can see from 1874 to 1950, that house was owned by landlords.
Yeah.
And it was also let out at some point in those intervening years. I now own it. I think that home ownership is a bit of a scintilla, it's a bit of a blip.
Yeah.
It didn't exist in the past, and I suspect it won't exist going forward to any large extent. It's a bit optimistic to say that I'm going to lose the deposit I put down, and that we're going to get more equal society, because I think that actually when we look at rents, even though they're ridiculous, they are affordable if you base it on a much lower standard of living, and that's my worry. You don't get borrowing rates, but you get implied much lower standards of living going forward. And so some of the ridiculous rents in London, if you live in £4 per house,
yeah,
sustainable, and that's my worry.
It is possible to do. Your only problem is you're gonna, these people are gonna get to vote every 5 years. Mm-hmm. Now, you can make it harder for them to register, and we've done that. You've got to individually register, and every time you move house you have, so private tenants are not registering. Oh, this is a brilliant thing about the EU referendum. People are registering to vote so they can vote in the referendum. Which means that because they're registering to vote, London will get another 7 constituencies when the boundaries are redrawn in the right areas. But you're right. We can have a kind of Blade Runner society. It is possible. You pay 80% of your income on rent. You can just about eat, but not much more. It is possible, but how do you get increasing numbers of people to vote for something that's so, and you could have more lotteries, you know, and you could tell people they could buy more lottery tickets with the final pound that they've got as hope. But that's why I don't think the people who are angriest about housing are people of my age in the top 10% in London who have just got a mortgage, but the mortgage might be £800,000 mortgage. Okay, the interest rate is low, but it's £800,000 for a three-bed house in Fulham. And they know if they're the ones who are caught out when the prices go, they could have negative equity of £100,000-£200,000. It would take them 20 years to pay off. When you have fairly right-wing, successful people being annoyed, things are possible. But I'd love to talk to you later about that house, because the thing I told you about the Netherlands, the reason we know about the house prices in the Netherlands is this one house where they've got the deeds from 1675 onwards, which is why they can work out in real terms that house prices can fall for 300 years. We have no idea that that is possible. If a place is no longer the centre of the universe, Amsterdam was the centre of the universe then. London is currently the centre of the universe. It has the highest proportion of billionaires on the planet. It is the place to go. Everywhere that is the centre stops being the centre at some point. It's not going to carry on forever. And we just don't imagine that's possible. And it's partly that we don't imagine it's possible that it can get this ridiculous, because you don't get a bubble without people not thinking it's a bubble.
Yes.
Yeah, interesting what you said about the legacy of empire. There's been sort of cultural transmission ever since the time of Elizabeth I. But these sort of cultural transmission lines do break down and get kinked, if you like. I mean, it's social democracy in Sweden. I mean, there's a cultural inheritance there from way, way back, and it seems to be petering out to a certain extent. Regarding Britain, I mean, wasn't there a substantial legacy left from 1945 to 1951 that lingered on until the aforesaid lady from Grantham got power? But where did it all go? You know, I mean, I missed out because I went to a secondary model school, very secondary, not remotely modern, along with most other people. The experience of going to school with, which was, my cultural, individual cultural legacy. But all the people who got Attlee in 1945, what happened? What did it disappear, as Ken Loach's film pointed out?
They were, I mean, not the people who voted for him, they were around, but the people who got him in were dead by 1979. People of his age and older. So when I talk about my granddad, that's a young man in 45. But the people who had children in the 30s, who were really angry about what had happened in the 30s, some had died and they were older and it was forgotten. And the new selfishness was encouraged, which came with Thatcher. Which was that tall poppies rise, it's down to you, there is no such thing as society, there's only you and your family. Look after yourself and you'll be okay, otherwise you're a scrounger because you're relying on other people. And that ethos was built up. And it moved the whole centre of politics, so that some of the things that Blair did, Thatcher would never have done. In Scandinavian countries, it sometimes looks as if it's going. But then you see things like the Free Finns, who are a right-wing party in Finland, introducing a basic income next year. And they might do it in a right-wing way, but it's things are very, very different. What people call left and right in other countries are not like our left and right. So Angela Merkel, we talk about her as a right-wing politician. She's a right-wing politician who supports tax rates much higher than we have, and who's allowed a million people into a country where we wouldn't allow in 20,000. But for Germany, she's right wing.
I'm a local art activist, and I have been pleasantly surprised, because for the last 2 days I've been teaching children art who come from deprived areas or have been excluded from mainstream education. And quite a challenging bunch, they can be too. But this week I have been amazed by the fact that they're ranging from 9 to about 11 or 12 years old, These children have an idea, quite clear idea, what is right and wrong and fair in society. It's an assumption to think they do not understand or listen to people or talking adults to me or anything else. I had a brilliant conversation with a young chap today who had quite a clear idea about poverty, inequality, racism, and the feedback I got off of these children is priceless. We were talking about small conversations, these conversations, and it wasn't what I was imparting on these kids. We did an exercise of what they thought was right and wrong on post-it notes. We transferred those onto posters and we occupied Berlin Woods. We had a camp and demonstrated at Berlin Woods, which is in the middle of nowhere, where these kids had a chance to express themselves and what they thought was right and wrong. Now, I would say that the conversation, small conversation, is not what they learnt from me, but on what I learnt from them. Yeah. And it's not for people of my age, I'm 50 plus, to assume that these children, these up-and-coming young adults, don't know how it is because they do. And they're the people who are going to be needed when perceived middle-aged, elderly, rich, that are perceived to be out there all start to pass away. And there's a polarisation between the 1% and the 99%. Mm. I am totally blown away and inspired by the young people. I just wanted to kind of share that, in particular what you were talking about, small conversations, yeah. What I've learned today from these young people. And I'm very confident that dialogue that the people having about post-capitalism things is
Lots of things have changed, and we don't talk about things that got dramatically better. So levels of racism have dropped everywhere. They dropped fastest in London, but they really have dropped. We don't have things like National Front anymore. That's gone down. Sexism, is it? Yeah. Oh well, I mean, one way you can go all the way from Mosley to the NF to the BNP, who are nasty. I don't like UKIP, but they're not as bad as those. And if you really want, partly to insult them, partly it's true, one sign that we're becoming, slowly, gradually becoming a normal European country is all large European countries have a bunch of semi-fascists, you know, have a large right-wing party. It's a European thing to do. And before, you know, they're there, they're dangerous, then they're not as nasty as the BNP, but the views are there. You know, the views are held scratch under the surface. And isn't it terrible all these people came in? You know, all these people that have come in, mostly from the rest of Europe, with their bloody qualifications and somebody else having paid for their education, and all coming in and staffing our hospitals and teaching our children in our schools, and cleaning the hotels and doing everything else. And us sending all our retirees to Spain and Malta so somebody else's health service looks after them. This is terrible, and we've got to stop it so that we can have all our pensioners come back and we can send all the doctors out. I mean, if you want, you know, I've gone on too much about housing crashes, my idea. And I'm not this, you know, so I don't. If we did vote to leave, it's a bit like in Scotland, if 5.5% of people have voted differently in Scotland, it would have all changed in England. We'd have had a run on the pound because you've got sterling based on no oil. If we vote to leave, then it's all up in the air. And you could get dramatic change to British society very quickly. I'm just too boring and old to want to risk it. Partly because the city I live in, a third of our income in the two universities comes from Europe. The mini plant, which is 1% of our exports, industrial exports of the whole country, the mini plant, is owned by BMW, who have basically sent a letter to all the workers, that's only 3,000 now, which between the lines says, this plant will be moving if that vote goes that way, just to let you know, so you doesn't, you know, if you want, I don't think there's a city that will be more hurt by leaving. But our house prices will go down really low. Because people will have to find somewhere else to work. But no, I do share optimism about young people and what they say, except, just to go back to the grammar schools, I do talk to 16-year-olds in different schools, and the most, and 16-year-olds are very different from 18-year-olds. 18-year-olds are a bit more careful of what they say. 16-year-olds is just war. 16-year-olds in Birmingham grammar schools is where I get the most kind of vicious, it's just up to you, and if you do well, that's okay, and if you don't, you don't. And that's why I worry about these kind of schools. Top public schools, just a bit more cultured, a bit more realising they're there because the family's got money. Whereas the Birmingham grammar schools, they're there because they're very clever and they've been picked to be there, and they're going to go upwards.
This is a rather an old story, but when Attlee won in 1951, lost the election in 1951, I believe I'm right in saying he had the highest vote that anyone's had in politics in this country ever. Since then, we've been grinding on with this unfair electoral system. You should go back and read, I've just been reading Trollope actually, where he describes very clearly what the problems with the sort of system are, but we haven't learned. But nearly all European countries, if not all, do have a proportional system. To get rid of it in this country, I mean, this is why none of these heroes we've been mentioning, Blair, Thatcher, who were the rest of them, had very hard, they didn't come in on a great popular vote, they came on a pathetically small vote. Nobody really wants them. If you go around Canada talking to people on doorsteps, they say, what's the point of voting? They're all the same. And they are, I just feel that we're not really likely to get anywhere unless we can actually have
we get PR. But John McDonald has publicly said he will campaign to have PR in the Labour manifesto. He'll have a job, but that party doesn't learn. Partly because it won, I think, in 2010 with just 20% of the electorate. So Labour knows it can get to power with just 20% of the electorate. I think the Tories won with 25% of the electorate. If you want... claiming he knows everything on this, but okay, how I would go for winning the 2020 election, or earlier if there's a crisis. Cameron has to resign if the referendum goes, and then you get a snap election. If you want to beat the Tories, you offer something very different, and then large numbers of people who never vote could vote, which is what happened in Scotland. 85% turnout, the highest since the franchise. You offer PR on your manifesto. The Greens will do anything you want if you offer PR. You can give the Greens a couple of seats to go for. The Greens didn't stand in Chester last time. It was a local deal. Labour won by 90-odd votes. But it's not allowed, but it happened. You give the Greens a seat in Norwich to go for, a seat in Bristol, Brighton, Central York. And the Greens eco-cycle out of everywhere else and go and campaign in those four seats. And you get that. You talk to the S. You don't waste time and energy with the SNP. You accept Scotland's gone. One reason Labour should go for PR is that if they want to get an MP from Scotland again, that'll get them. You talk to Lib. As soon as you have any of that kind of organisation, the Tories cannot win an election. But they rely on you not doing it. And what really annoys me is that the Tories do it. So they walked out of Nick Clegg's constituency in Hallam. They left a candidate there just to tell people not to vote for him. The Clegg was only elected in 2015 with the help of the Conservatives. So they do this. But on the left of British politics, the greatest hatred is between Labour and the Greens locally and a few Liberals, and then the more left people, the National Health Alliance, who really dislike each other because they know each other and they're taking votes off each other. And there's no need for that.